Trump versus Harvard in a Political Wrestling Match by Ron Unz. Published April 21st, 2025 in the Unz Review. Back when I was a young child, my grandfather enjoyed watching professional wrestling on his old black and white television, so I occasionally did the same. In those distant days, television wrestling possessed almost no money nor prestige and was barely even considered a real sport, probably tied with roller derby as drawing the bottommost tier of audience viewership. Wrestling matches were only carried on one of the lowest-rated local television stations, unaffiliated with any network, whose managers desperately sought out anything they could find to fill their available broadcast hours. The notion that wrestling might someday become a multi-billion dollar national business enterprise would have seemed totally outlandish and ridiculous. And although a 1975 Hollywood science fiction film called Rollerball envisioned a future America in which a lethal version of roller derby had become the number one sport, no one ever suggested anything similar for wrestling. Although I've never watched a single wrestling match since those black and white shows of my childhood, and those memories have faded, I think they may have often featured tag team contests in which pairs of wrestlers faced off against each other. If so, then our national headlines are now proclaiming a heavyweight wrestling match to determine the future of American higher education and perhaps our entire society as well. President Donald Trump is facing off against Harvard University in the greatest political bout of this young century, with each of those primary contenders backed by their chosen seconds. Trump is a noted author with more than 20 published volumes to his name, many of them high-profile bestsellers on business strategy, politics, and negotiation. But I'm not entirely convinced that he's ever actually read a single book cover to cover in his entire life, even including any of his own. And if he did, I suspect that the last one may have been decades ago, perhaps filled with many colorful pictures. Meanwhile, his main opponent in that match is America's oldest university, now approaching its 390th year of existence, long ranked as the world's wealthiest and most prestigious institution of higher education. Trump's loyal teammate is his Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, the billionaire wrestling lady, while Harvard is backed by Columbia University, still smarting from the brutal beatdown it recently received at the hands of the Trump-McMahon team before Harvard had entered the lists. Although wealthy and very prestigious, Columbia still probably ranks a bit below the long-standing Harvard-Yale-Princeton triumvirate. Therefore, the threatened loss of $400 million in annual federal funding a few weeks ago brought the university to its knees, forcing its administration to surrender on all the main points demanded. Teams of federal agents were allowed to raid student housing and drag off any non-citizen suspected of criticizing Israel. The administration agreed to create a special unit of 30 campus security officers tasked with suppressing any public displays of anti-Zionism, and its prestigious Middle East Studies program was placed under a regime of academic receivership, presumably intended to ensure that it became entirely pro-Israel in its teachings. All these concessions were made by acting President Katrina Armstrong, who afterwards resigned due to the horrific pressure she had endured, becoming the second president of Columbia to do so in just the last 8 months. So based upon this painful recent history, we are clearly seeing the sort of grudge match that has become wildly popular in pro wrestling, with Columbia eager for its share of revenge now that it has mighty Harvard on its side. In pro wrestling, as in other spectator sports, the onlookers can side with one of the champions or the other, or else merely enjoy the battle without taking sides. Given Trump's ignorance and the stupidity of his policies, most recently demonstrated by his Looney Tunes tariff proposals, I certainly couldn't see myself cheering for him. But instead of avoiding taking any sides, I found myself entirely in Harvard's corner in this bout. My position might seem a bit strange, given the harsh criticism that I've leveled at my alma mater over the years, even on some of the very matters that the Trump administration is fiercely attacking. For example, as far back as late 2012, I'd published a short piece arguing that the Harvard had gradually transformed itself from a great academic center of learning into an enormous hedge fund with some sort of small school or something attached off to one side. Paying tuition to a giant hedge fund. Ron Unz, The American Conservative, December 4, 2012, 1,300 words. As I noted in a follow-up column a few days later, my criticism had deeply resonated in liberal journalistic circles, and during the years since then, denouncing our elite universities as disguised hedge funds has become a widespread criticism. Late Friday afternoon, the piece was prominently featured on the Business Insider and CNBC websites, and soon redistributed on Twitter by a large throng of individuals, some of them prominent journalists. MSNBC's Chris Hayes tweeted, "Very jealous I did not write this article," to his 175,000 followers. Pulitzer Prize winner Bart Gellman described it as eye-opening, and New York Times economic policy writer Ann Lowry used the phrase Harvard as a giant hedge fund plus a wee research university. Moreover, that particular piece had actually been published as a sidebar to my extremely long analysis of the admissions practices at Harvard and our other most elite universities, which together served as a direct funnel to the commanding heights of American academics, law, business, media, and finance. My statistics demonstrated that their admissions process had become hopelessly corrupt, and I summarized these conclusions. In recent decades, elite college admissions policy has frequently become an ideological battlefield between liberals and conservatives, but I would argue that both these warring camps have been missing the actual reality of the situation. Conservatives have denounced affirmative action policies, which emphasize race over academic merit, and thereby lead to the enrollment of lesser qualified blacks and Hispanics over their more qualified white and Asian competitors. They argue that our elite institutions should be colorblind and race neutral. Meanwhile, liberals have countered that the student body of these institutions should look like America, at least approximately, and that ethnic and racial diversity intrinsically provide important educational benefits, at least if all admitted students are reasonably qualified and able to do the work. My own position has always been strongly in the former camp, supporting meritocracy over diversity in elite admissions. But based upon the detailed evidence I have discussed above, it appears that both these ideological values have gradually been overwhelmed and replaced by the influence of corruption and ethnic favoritism, thereby selecting future American elites which are not meritocratic nor diverse, neither being drawn from our most able students nor reasonably reflecting the general American population. The overwhelming evidence is that the system currently employed by most of our leading universities admits applicants whose ability may be unremarkable, but who are the beneficiaries of underhanded manipulation and favoritism. Nations which put their future national leadership in the hands of such individuals are likely to encounter enormous economic and social problems, exactly the sort of problems which our own country seems to have increasingly experienced over the last couple of decades. And unless the absurdly skewed enrollments of our elite academic institutions are corrected, the composition of these feeder institutions will ensure that such national problems only continue to grow worse as time passes. The myth of American meritocracy, Ron Unz, The American Conservative, November 28, 2012, 26,200 words. New York Times columnist David Brooks soon ranked my piece as perhaps the best American magazine article of the year, a verdict strongly seconded by a top editor at The Economist. The Yale Political Union and the Yale Law School invited me to give a couple of public lectures on that controversial conclusion and the rest of my meritocracy analysis. A very long list of other writers and public intellectuals commented on my article, an overwhelming majority of them quite favorably, with their discussions appearing in Forbes, The Atlantic, The Washington Monthly, Business Insider, and various other publications. These included such prominent public figures as Harvard professor Neil Ferguson and Fareed Zakaria. One of my central findings had been the existence of very strong quantitative evidence that Harvard and the other Ivy League schools were practicing racial discrimination by surreptitiously maintaining Asian quotas in their admissions policies, and this soon prompted the New York Times to organize an important symposium on that explosive topic, in which I eagerly participated. My graph demonstrating the extremely suspicious convergence of Asian enrollment across the Ivies was very widely distributed across the Internet, including being republished by the Times, and seemed to constitute smoking gun proof of what had long been a widely held suspicion. As I explained in my Times piece, after the Justice Department closed an investigation in the early 1990s into charges that Harvard University discriminated against Asian American applicants, Harvard's reported enrollment of Asian Americans began gradually declining, falling from 20.6% in 1993 to about 16.5% over most of the last decade. This decline might seem small, but these same years brought a huge increase in America's college-age Asian population, which roughly doubled between 1992 and 2011, while non-Hispanic white numbers remained almost unchanged. Thus, according to official statistics, the percentage of Asian Americans enrolled at Harvard fell by more than 50% over the last two decades, while the percentage of whites changed little. This decline in relative Asian American enrollment was actually larger than the impact of Harvard's 1925 Jewish quota, which reduced Jewish freshmen from 27.6% to 15%. Conservative circles took considerable interest, with Charles Murray highlighting my analysis, and a few weeks later I published a piece in National Review arguing that my findings might provide legal grounds for the Supreme Court to overturn its 1978 Bakke decision that laid the basis for decades of affirmative action policies. Racial quotas, Harvard, and the legacy of Bakke. Have three decades of Supreme Court support for affirmative action been based on fraud? Ron Unz, National Review, February 18, 2013, 800 words. Indeed, the following year, a group of Asian American plaintiffs filed their lawsuit challenging Harvard's admission system as discriminatory. Their case spent the next decade wending its way through federal court. Then on June 29, 2023, their effort culminated in a decisive 6-3 Supreme Court ruling overturning Bakke after 45 years. That judicial thunderbolt largely eliminated legal basis for affirmative action in college admissions and many other areas of American society. Although I'd obviously wished those Asian plaintiffs well in their legal effort, I hadn't been involved in their lawsuit, and had actually been fairly pessimistic about their chances. Over the decades, there had been several previous efforts to persuade the Supreme Court to overturn Bakke, but all of those failed, so that I'd come to believe that such a legal project was probably hopeless. However, even as that case gradually moved through the courts, I launched an entirely different campaign aimed at drastically reforming educational policy at Harvard and doing the same at many of our other elite universities. In 2015, the New York Times had solicited my views for a symposium on reforming elite American higher education admissions. In my piece, I noted that Harvard and some of our other most elite colleges had accumulated such enormous endowments that the portion of their income derived from undergraduate revenue had become utterly insignificant. Therefore, I argued that they should simply abolish college tuition. The numbers tell the story. These days, Harvard's 6,600 undergraduates are charged annual tuition of $44,000 per year, with substantial reductions for students from less wealthy families. So student tuition probably contributes less than $200 million to Harvard's annual revenue. Meanwhile, the hedge fund side of Harvard's operations last year generated a $5 billion return, an amount at least 25 times larger. If all of Harvard's college students disappeared tomorrow or attended classes without paying a dime, the financial impact on Harvard, Inc. would be completely negligible. But although those tuition dollars mean almost nothing to Harvard, they are surely a daunting barrier and burden to almost any American family. An admissions policy is flawed when a four-year total price tag approaching $250,000 probably deters many students from even applying. The announcement of a free Harvard education would capture the world's imagination and draw a vastly broader and more diverse applicant pool, including many high-ability students who had previously limited their aim to their local state college. Furthermore, everything I've said about Harvard applies equally well to most of America's other most top universities, including Yale, Princeton, and Stanford, which have also become huge untaxed hedge funds that charge exorbitant tuition. They could just as easily provide free college educations to their students at little financial cost and great social benefit. I later produced charts illustrating that only a tiny sliver of Harvard's income came from college tuition, with the same being true for Yale, Princeton, and Stanford. It was obvious to me that a public announcement by Harvard that it was abolishing all college tuition would capture the imagination of the entire world and quickly prompt many of our wealthiest and most elite colleges to do the same. So I found it extremely frustrating that it was equally obvious that Harvard's hidebound administration would never consider taking such a bold and beneficial step. Therefore, later that same year, I organized the Free Harvard, Fair Harvard slate of candidates for the Harvard Board of Overseers, recruiting longtime progressive icon Ralph Nader to head our ticket. We ran on a platform of abolishing college tuition while also requiring the university to provide much greater transparency in its admissions decisions. An excellent, even-handed early account of our campaign soon appeared in Harvard Magazine. Overseers petitioners challenge Harvard policies. John S. Rosenberg, Harvard Magazine, January 27, 2016, 9,000 words. Our Harvard campaign coincided exactly with Donald Trump's own run for the White House, and the unwillingness of the media to mention certain matters seemed to demonstrate that most editors and publishers were completely intimidated by Harvard power and influence. More than a dozen years earlier, Daniel Golden had won a Pulitzer Prize for a series of Wall Street Journal articles documenting the outrageous corruption and favoritism in the admissions practices of Harvard and our other top universities. Then in 2006, he'd published The Price of Admission, a widely praised bestseller on that same topic, and I heavily drawn upon it for my own meritocracy analysis. Among other shocking facts, Golden revealed the existence of something often called the Harvard Price, a specific multi-million-dollar payment, essentially a bribe, that would persuade our most prestigious college to admit an underqualified applicant. Due to a bitter family lawsuit, he was able to document the specific example of Jared Kushner, a totally unqualified student whose parents had bought him his prestigious Harvard admission with exactly such a secret payment. Kushner was Trump's son-in-law and a leading figure in his 2016 presidential campaign. Given that the entire media was constantly attacking Trump on every possible issue, I naturally assumed they would begin raking him over the coals on this, thereby boosting our own Harvard overseer campaign challenging such practices. But despite our best efforts, the media kept entirely silent on that outrageous example of familial corruption, apparently too fearful of alienating Harvard to ever mention that scandal. So while Trump won the nomination and went on to win the presidency, our Harvard ticket went down to defeat. Several years ago, I published a comprehensive history of that unsuccessful campaign as part of a very long review article discussing all aspects of the meritocracy issue. American Meritocracy Revisited, Elite Admissions, Asian Quotas, and the Free Harvard, Fair Harvard Campaign. Ron Unz, The Unz Review, May 4th, 2022, 28,400 words. I think that if Harvard had endorsed any of these important reforms regarding admissions fairness or tuition, it might have greatly boosted its public support across the ideological spectrum. But instead, it stubbornly resisted all these proposals, and its vast wealth and arrogance increasingly alienated large portions of the American public, ensuring that it became seen as a widely hated institution of our despised ruling class. This left it vulnerable to the sudden, unexpected populist attack of President Donald Trump, and most of America's other elite universities have fallen into the same trap. Given all these facts, under other circumstances, I might have welcomed Trump's attack upon all these arrogant and corrupt academic institutions, so that I would have at least remained neutral. But it was obvious that the reasons for his crusade against Harvard, Columbia, and so many other top universities had little, if anything, to do with these very legitimate criticisms, but was instead motivated by entirely different factors. For many decades, elite college students have regularly engaged in public protests on a wide variety of different issues and been lionized by the media and academic communities for doing so, with the Black Lives Matter movement of 2020 being merely the most recent example. But as I have discussed in a long series of articles, most recently a month ago, that ideological climate suddenly changed in October 2023. That long history of permitting or even glorifying public protests against perceived injustices had naturally been absorbed and taken to heart by the young college students who began their classes in September 2023. Then within a few weeks, a remarkably daring surprise raid by the Hamas militants of long-besieged Gaza caught the Israelis napping and surmounted the high-tech defenses that cost perhaps $500 million to construct. Many hundreds of Israeli soldiers and security officers were killed, along with similar numbers of civilians, with most of the latter probably dying from the friendly fire of Israel's own panic-stricken and trigger-happy military units. Some 240 Israeli soldiers and civilians were captured and taken back to Gaza as prisoners, with Hamas hoping to exchange them for the freedom of the many thousands of Palestinian civilians who had been held for years in Israeli prisons, often under brutal conditions. Instead of attacking Hamas, Netanyahu took advantage of the wave of global sympathy by unleashing an unprecedented military assault against Gaza's more than 2 million civilians, apparently intending to kill huge numbers of them and drive the remainder into Egypt's Sinai Desert, allowing Israel to annex their territory and resettle it with Jews. Secure in their underground tunnels, relatively few Hamas fighters were killed, but Gaza civilians suffered devastating losses, much of it inflicted by 2,000-pound bombs, almost never previously deployed against urban targets. Large portions of Gaza were soon transformed into moonscapes, with some 100,000 buildings destroyed, including hospitals, churches, mosques, schools, universities, government offices, bakeries, and all the other infrastructure necessary for maintaining civilian life. After just a few weeks, the Financial Times reported that the destruction inflicted upon much of Gaza was already worse than had been suffered by German cities after years of Allied bombing attacks during World War II. With Israel's leaders publicly declaring their genocidal plans for their Palestinian enemies, and Israeli troops committing the greatest televised massacre of helpless civilians in the history of the world, international organizations gradually came under strong pressure to involve themselves in the ongoing conflict. In late December, South Africa filed a 91-page legal brief with the International Court of Justice, ICJ, accusing Israel of committing genocide. Within a few weeks, the ICJ jurists issued a series of near-unanimous rulings supporting those charges and declaring that the Gazans were at serious risk of suffering a potential genocide at Israel's hands, with Israel's own appointed judge, a former Chief Justice of the Israeli Supreme Court, concurring in most of those verdicts. For generations, college students had been heavily indoctrinated with the horrors of the Holocaust, endlessly told that they must never remain silent while helpless men, women, and children were brutally attacked and slaughtered. The images they now saw of devastated cities and dead or dying children seemed exactly like something out of the movies, but they were instead happening in real time in the physical world. Within weeks, student activists all across American college campuses began organizing public protests against the horrendous massacre that Israel was committing, with students at Harvard and Columbia taking the lead. As a consequence of these strong youthful sentiments, anti-Israel demonstrations have erupted at many of our universities, outraging numerous pro-Israel billionaire donors. Almost immediately, some of the latter launched a harsh retaliatory campaign, with many corporate leaders declaring they would permanently blacklist from future employment opportunities any college students publicly supporting the Palestinian cause, underscoring these threats with a widespread doxing campaign at Harvard and other elite colleges. A few weeks ago, our uniformly pro-Israel elected officials entered the fray, calling the presidents of several of our most elite colleges, Harvard, Penn, and MIT, to testify before them regarding alleged anti-Semitism on their campuses. Members of Congress severely browbeat these officials for permitting anti-Israel activities, even ignorantly and absurdly accusing them of allowing public calls for Jewish genocide on their campuses. The responses of these college leaders emphasized their support for freedom of political speech, but were deemed so unsatisfactory by pro-Israel donors and their mainstream media allies that enormous pressure was exerted to remove them. Within days, the Penn president and her supportive board chairman had been forced to resign, and soon afterwards, Harvard's first black president suffered the same fate, as pro-Israel groups released evidence of her widespread academic plagiarism to drive her from office. I am unaware of any previous case in which the president of an elite American college had been so rapidly removed from office for ideological reasons, and two successive examples within just a few weeks seems an absolutely unprecedented development, having enormous implications for academic freedom. As a result of this massive political pressure, these widespread college protests were brutally crushed, with some 2,300 students arrested at dozens of universities all across the country. A crackdown on freedom of political speech at American universities never previously seen. But despite this major success, the Zionist billionaire donors regarded their victory over the protesters as incomplete. With the pro-Israel Biden administration now replaced by the even more strongly pro-Israel Trump administration, they demanded that this campaign be extended to rooting out the ideological forces that they deemed responsible. Under their influence, Trump and his top aides declared their intent to arrest and deport any foreign students who had participated in those campus protests or otherwise expressed their sharp criticism of Israel, and this soon led to a series of shocking incidents. A young Turkish doctoral candidate attending Tufts University on a Fulbright scholarship was snatched off the streets of her Boston-area town by six masked federal agents, hustled into an unmarked car, and transferred to a holding cell in Louisiana in preparation for her deportation. Other raids on Columbia student housing by teams of federal agents picked up a Palestinian green card holder with an American citizen wife 8 months pregnant. A South Korean undergraduate who had lived in the U.S. since the age of 7 went into hiding to avoid a similar fate, while a student from India quickly fled to Canada to avoid arrest. None of these university students had committed any crimes, but they were seized by federal agents in campus raids or abducted from the streets of their cities for merely having expressed public criticism of the foreign government of Israel. Nothing as bizarre as this had ever previously happened in America. The number of foreign students ordered deported for criticizing Israel has now reached 1,500. In past decades, the academic leadership of a top Ivy League school such as Columbia might have stoutly defended the students in its community. But any such resistance was broken when the Trump administration suddenly pulled $400 million in annual funding. The demands included full cooperation with the arrest of any students critical of Israeli policies, the creation of new internal security force to suppress any anti-Israel campus protests, and receivership for the university's prestigious Middle East Studies program, presumably resulting in firm Zionist control. Acting President Katrina Armstrong bowed to those demands, sacrificing the academic freedom of her faculty members and the personal freedom of her students. But faced with such enormous conflicting pressures, she then resigned on Friday evening, some 8 months after her predecessor had resigned for roughly similar reasons. That same day, newspapers also reported that the top leadership of Harvard University's equally prestigious Middle Eastern Studies Center had been dismissed, probably ensuring that after more than 70 years, this independent academic organization would henceforth become firmly pro-Israel in its orientation. Last year, after Harvard's previous president had strongly defended academic freedom before a hostile congressional committee, she was quickly forced to resign. The stated excuse used by the Trump administration for this unprecedented attack on freedom of speech and academic freedom at American universities was the overriding government goal of combating anti-Semitism. And I noticed the extreme ironies in this position. This is certainly an odd situation, warranting careful analysis and explanation. The word anti-Semitism merely means criticizing or disliking Jews, and in recent years, Israel's partisans have demanded with some success that the term should be extended to encompass anti-Zionism as well, namely hostility to the Jewish state. But let us suppose that we concede the latter point and agree with pro-Israel activists that anti-Zionism is indeed a form of anti-Semitism. Over the last few months, the Israeli government has brutally slaughtered tens of thousands of helpless civilians in Gaza, committing the greatest televised massacre in the history of the world, with its top leaders using explicitly genocidal language to describe their plans for the Palestinians. Indeed, the South African government submitted a 91-page legal brief to the International Court of Justice, cataloging those Israeli statements, prompting a near-unanimous ruling by the jurists that millions of Palestinians face the prospect of genocide at Israeli hands. These days, most Westerners claim to regard genocide in a decidedly negative light. So does this not syllogistically require them to embrace and endorse anti-Semitism? Surely a visitor from Mars would be very puzzled by this strange dilemma and the philosophical and psychological contortions it seems to require. It is rather surprising that the extremely politically correct ruling elites of America and the rest of the Western world are loudly cheering on the racially exclusivist state of Israel, even as it kills enormous numbers of women and children and works very hard to starve to death some 2 million civilians in its unprecedented genocidal rampage. After all, the far milder and more circumspect regime of apartheid South Africa was universally condemned, boycotted, and sanctioned for merely the tiniest sliver of such misdeeds. My article went on to mention that Congress had also begun passing legislation to suppress freedom of speech on university campuses in the name of combating anti-Semitism, with that latter term being very loosely defined. Some years ago, a former senior AIPAC official once boasted to a friendly journalist that if he wrote anything on a cocktail napkin, within 24 hours he could get the signatures of 70 senators to endorse it, and the political power of the ADL is equally formidable. Therefore, it was hardly surprising that last week an overwhelmingly bipartisan 320-91 majority in the House passed a bill broadening the meaning of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism in the anti-discrimination policies of the Department of Education by codifying the definitions used in our civil rights laws to classify those ideas as discriminatory. Although I haven't tried to read the text, the obvious intent is to force colleges to expunge such noxious activities as anti-Israel protests from their campus community or face loss of federal funds. This represents a striking attack against academic freedom, as well as America's traditional freedom of speech and thought, and may also pressure other private organizations to adopt similar policies. In a particularly ironic twist, the definition of anti-Semitism used in the bill clearly covers portions of the Christian Bible. So the ignorant or compromised Republican legislators have now wholeheartedly endorsed banning the Bible in a country in which 95% of the population has Christian roots. The Zionist destruction of American higher education. Ron Unz, The Uns Review, March 31st, 2025, 7,300 words. These widespread Trump administration claims that anti-Semitism was rife across our elite universities were particularly outrageous given some of the most important findings in my original 2012 Meritocracy article, findings almost never mentioned anywhere in our pusillanimous media outlets. Just after the 2023 Supreme Court decision striking down Bakke and the legal basis for affirmative action, I published an article recapitulating some of my meritocracy analysis. Most American journalists and academics quietly recognize that matters touching upon Jewish sensitivities constitute the deadly third rail of their professions, and the quantitative analysis that I had presented in my 2012 meritocracy analysis was probably one of the most explosive published anywhere in many decades. In that study, I demonstrated that the distribution of students at our elite colleges sharply diverged from that of our society as a whole, or its highest performing segment, but instead showed a strikingly different ethnic skew. The evidence of the recent NMS semifinalist list seems the most conclusive of all, given the huge statistical sample sizes involved. As discussed above, these students constitute roughly the highest 0.5% in academic ability, the top 16,000 high school seniors who should be enrolling at the Ivy League and America's other most elite academic universities. In California, white Gentile names outnumber Jewish ones by over 8 to 1, in Texas, over 20 to 1, in Florida and Illinois, almost 9 to 1. Even in New York, America's most heavily Jewish state, there are more than 2 high-ability white Gentile students for every Jewish one. Based upon the overall distribution of America's population, it appears that approximately 65 to 70% of America's highest ability students are non-Jewish whites, well over 10 times the Jewish total of under 6%. Needless to say, these proportions are considerably different from what we actually find among the admitted students at Harvard and its elite peers, which today serve as a direct funnel to the commanding heights of American academics, law, business, and finance. Based on reported statistics, Jews approximately match or even outnumber non-Jewish whites at Harvard and most of the other Ivy League schools, which seems wildly disproportionate. Indeed, the official statistics indicate that non-Jewish whites at Harvard are America's most underrepresented population group, enrolled at a much lower fraction of their national population than blacks or Hispanics, despite having much higher academic test scores. When examining statistical evidence, the proper aggregation of data is critical. Consider the ratio of the recent 2007 to 2011 enrollment of Asian students at Harvard relative to their estimated share of America's recent NMS semifinalists, a reasonable proxy for the high-ability college-age population, and compare this result to the corresponding figure for whites. The Asian ratio is 63%, slightly above the white ratio of 61%. With both these figures being considerably below parity due to the substantial presence of underrepresented racial minorities such as blacks and Hispanics, foreign students, and students of unreported race. Thus, there appears to be no evidence for racial bias against Asians, even excluding the race-neutral impact of athletic recruitment, legacy admissions, and geographical diversity. However, if we separate out the Jewish students, their ratio turns out to be 435%, while the residual ratio for non-Jewish whites drops to just 28%, less than half of even the Asian figure. As a consequence, Asians appear underrepresented relative to Jews by a factor of 7, while non-Jewish whites are by far the most underrepresented group of all, despite any benefits they might receive from athletic, legacy, or geographical distribution factors. The rest of the Ivy League tends to follow a similar pattern, with the overall Jewish ratio being 381%, the Asian figure at 62%, and the ratio for non-Jewish whites a low 35%, all relative to their number of high-ability college-age students. Just as striking as these wildly disproportionate current numbers have been the longer enrollment trends. In the 3 decades since I graduated Harvard, the presence of white Gentiles has dropped by as much as 70%, despite no remotely comparable decline in their relative size or academic performance of that population. Meanwhile, the percentage of Jewish students has actually increased. This period certainly saw a very rapid rise in the number of Asian, Hispanic, and foreign students, as well as some increase in blacks. But it seems rather odd that all of these other gains would have come at the expense of whites of Christian background and none at the expense of Jews. Based on these figures, Jewish students are roughly 1,000% more likely to be enrolled at Harvard and the rest of the Ivy League than white Gentiles of similar ability. This was an absolutely astonishing result, given that underrepresentation in the range of 20 or 30% is often treated by courts as powerful prima facie evidence of racial discrimination. Several of my charts and graphs effectively presented these remarkable findings. These charts demonstrated the hidden reality that white Gentiles were heavily underrepresented at elite colleges, not merely with regard to their fraction of highest performing students, but even relative to their share of the college-age population. Academic administrators might publicly fret that blacks or Hispanics were not enrolled proportional to their national numbers, but the under-enrollment of non-Jewish whites was actually far more severe. To a considerable extent, the student bodies of our top colleges constitute the next generation of our national elites in embryonic form. And during recent decades, white Gentiles have increasingly been excluded from that important pool. All these meritocracy statistics were originally compiled 10 years ago. But when I've occasionally updated them, I noticed that little had changed, except that they had sometimes grown even more extreme. As mentioned, legal discovery eventually revealed that an internal Harvard study had largely confirmed my analysis of Asian discrimination, but had been suppressed. Meanwhile, my much more explosive analysis of massive Jewish overrepresentation had never been significantly challenged, despite the angry fulminations of a few agitated Jewish activists. But the topic had unsurprisingly disappeared from any public debate. Affirmative action and the Jewish elephant in the room. Ron Unz, The Unz Review, July 3, 2023, 6,800 words. Despite its vast wealth, storied history, and enormous global prestige, Harvard University initially seemed far too intimidated by Trump's attacks to challenge him, and instead began making concession after concession. But the Trump administration naturally interpreted this as a sign of weakness and steadily escalated its demands, finally sending a letter requiring a total surrender of Harvard's academic freedom. This amounted to a federal takeover by Trump's government and the billionaire wrestling lady he had placed in charge of his educational policy. Faced with such a terrible prospect, the world's most elite academic institution finally decided that it would stand its ground, and 1 week ago Harvard issued a firm public rejection of that proposal. Such courage touched off a huge wave of national media coverage, notably in the New York Times, while an angry President Trump illegally threatened to revoke Harvard's nonprofit status and essentially destroy the university. For more than 45 years, I'd been a subscriber to the print edition of the Times, carefully reading it almost every morning. But in recent years, I'd grown more and more disgusted by the sharp decline in its quality, with objectivity having been overwhelmed by ideological enthusiasm. And earlier this year, I finally let my subscription lapse. However, I still maintained my online subscription, and most days casually glanced at the Times homepage, sometimes reading an article or two. But I quickly discovered that the Trump versus Harvard political match had unleashed an enormous avalanche of coverage, including at least 18 different articles in just the first few days, authored by nearly 30 different staff writers. No previous challenge to Trump's authority had aroused even a fraction of such coverage, clearly demonstrating the dramatic political importance of this epic Trump versus Harvard duel. Reading all those articles, I found most of them seemed pretty good. Some carried the familiar bylines of the Times writers who had previously covered our failed Harvard overseer campaign or the Asian lawsuit against Harvard that led the Supreme Court to overturn the Bakke decision. I even noticed a couple of articles by one of the young Harvard Crimson journalists who had covered that 2016 campaign, now doing the same for tax policy and the IRS at the Times. Several of these articles emphasized that Harvard's decision to stand and fight had now inspired many other American universities to do the same in the name of academic freedom, with my local Palo Alto newspaper reporting that powerful Stanford had fully endorsed Harvard's effort. But if mighty Harvard had given in, experts agreed that no other college would have dared resist. The consequences of this Trump versus Harvard battle probably extend far beyond educational policy. According to the U.S. Constitution, all changes in tax or tariff policy must be passed by Congress. But when Trump raised our tariff taxes by a factor of 10, he did so by emergency decree and personal whim, and no one in Congress dared challenge him. The legal doctrine of habeas corpus stretches back more than 700 years in English common law. But when Trump claimed it no longer applied to some in our society, he encountered only weak pushback. Teams of masked federal agents have snatched students off the streets into unmarked cars merely for writing campus newspaper op-eds criticizing Israel. And this has occurred without any serious opposition. Decades of legal precedents have established that the president cannot fire members of independent agencies nor abolish those bodies if they were authorized by Congress. Yet Trump has been doing exactly this, most recently claiming the right to remove the chairman of the Independent Federal Reserve, powers that no previous president had ever claimed. Even during wartime, our presidents have generally required authorization from Congress to enact major policies, but Trump has totally ignored this constitutional framework. I doubt that any previous president had established such one-man rule on foreign, economic, and domestic policies, essentially governing through a series of emergency decrees and doing so in extremely erratic fashion. This seems far more reminiscent of the caudillos of turbulent Latin American nations than our own constitutional system. A right-wing British podcaster who interviewed me suggested that Trump reminded him of Caligula. But Harvard has now become the first powerful American institution to directly challenge Trump's outrageously autocratic governance, and this obviously explains the 18 articles and 30 staff writers that the Times assigned to the issue. So despite Harvard's long history of arrogance, corruption, administrative incompetence, and unfairness, that university is now standing up for American freedom when almost no other major centers of power have been willing to do so. Thus, the political wrestling match between Trump and Harvard may help determine not only the future of our system of higher education, but also our entire constitutional system as well. And all right-thinking individuals should take their stand in the university's corner. Several months ago, I was interviewed by a small Chinese media organization. In one of the video segments viewed well over a 500,000 times, I suggested that America might be on the cusp of a revolutionary situation, and that public disillusionment with Trump's policies might lead to this dramatic outcome. This may or may not have influenced a Chinese influencer living in Canada, whose very widely distributed TikTok video described something along similar lines, with Professor John Mearsheimer discussing it in a recent segment. All of these severe social and economic stresses in American society surely explain the enormous support that Trump has received from his populist base. But that support is completely unwarranted. Contrary to such hopes and expectations, Trump is a total ignoramus and merely the political puppet of the Zionist billionaire oligarchs who back him.